I want to move on to our next Al-Anon speaker. And I think most people of you may know of her or have heard of her. She was the one who was talking, Juanita from New Mexico. She was the one who was talking to John, to Don C. And she approached Norm, who started the first, who was instrumental in starting the first Native American conference in New Mexico, Albuquerque in 2017, together with Claire Reiswasser from the WSO. And so I'm gonna turn it over to Juanita.
Hi everyone, good afternoon. I'm glad to be here. My name is Juanita. I'm a very grateful member of the Worldwide Fellowship of Al-Anon. Thanks for asking me to do this, Yvonne. I think I'm always skeptical as to why I say yes, and then I'm finished and I'm going, oh, I'm glad I said yes, you know, but it always takes me a little while to get in there. I want to thank Don. I want to thank Don C, because Yvonne's right. Without Don, Native American Al-Anon, what we call is NAAC, we never would have gotten started. He really did say that this is what I remember him saying. And I know he'll tell me he'll correct me if I'm wrong. But what I remember him saying was, when he was taking the hoop around on all the sacred journeys throughout the country, each one every year was for a specific purpose. And if I'm not mistaken, the second one was for the healing of women and children. And he said that one of the things he realized was that Native American recovery on Indian land for alcoholism and drug addiction really was contingent on getting the women, the families, the wives, the children involved. He said, because it's just like when the sun comes up in the morning in the east, the sun, there's a direction, there's a natural direction for the sun. And he said, that's the direction of the woman. And that's like the woman has to come and be present. The family has to come and be present in order for the men and alcoholism to, for the recovery for that. And so I just really remember that. And he talked about it so often. And I do remember when Norm W. here in New Mexico became the minority coordinator. I put those two together, and the result is that we did have the first Native American Al-Anon conference in 1917 in Albuquerque. And we had the second and the third in Santa Fe. And then of course we had the fourth one scheduled in April of this year, and the virus happened, and so we canceled it. It was still early. It was gonna be the first weekend of April. And nobody was really adept at zooming around. And so, you know, we just canceled it. If it had been later, maybe, you know, we might've been able to rescue it for the 2020, but I think we did. I think Yvonne, you doing this weekend, I think is probably our 2020, you know, Native American conference. So I remember it must have been our second year after the first Native American Al-Anon conference had taken place, and we were coming back together as a committee, and we were ready to hand this off. Don was involved in this, and we all were like, yeah, I think we'll pass it on. Who wants to do it? We'll find another area that wants to do it, because we're tired, and let's move it on. And Don said to us, he said, you know, there is an order. He said, there's four seasons, and in order for things to progress in the natural order, he says, we really should do four seasons here in New Mexico. And so we did. I got to tell you that many of us were very reluctant. We didn't want to do it. And today I'll tell you that we're all very grateful that we had this experience. It was a wonderful experience to have, and we're all very, very grateful for it. So it really was an honor to be a part of that. And my part was just very, very small. It takes a committee to do anything. And we had a fantastic committee who all participated. And so if you haven't been here all day, you might not know, but the next Native American Al-Anon conference will be taking place in Portland, Oregon. And it's going to be April 30th, May 1st, and May 2nd. And this, what we're having this weekend is phenomenal. It's wonderful. I will tell you, and I'm getting shivers just thinking about it, when you're at the actual conference and you see the hoop coming up to the front in a place of honor, and you see the tobacco and you see the sage that is there to be prayed with and to be offered all weekend long, and you hear the heartbeat, those drums and the singers, it is, you just know you're part of something that is bigger than you, and you just know that you're part of a healing, and you're just part of. And it's not just for Native people. Anyone is involved, and anybody can be involved, and it is open to all. So thank you for that. And I had heard Rod before. My husband Tom and I used to go to this conference, and it was the end of May. It might have been Memorial Weekend, I can't remember, but it was in Canyon de Chelly, and it was fantastic. We would camp out. It was a camp out in Canyon de Chelly, and we would have our tents set up underneath the cottonwoods there in Canyon de Chelly, and we would have these incredible feasts. On Saturday night, the women would bring out their big pots, and they would make fry bread, and they'd have their mutton stew. And what a deal that was that evening. And we would hear the speakers underneath the cottonwoods, or we would have meetings in, you know, underneath or next to the sacred ruins down in the canyon. And when I remember when we heard Rod, it was a weekend when it was storming. It was raining all weekend long. And we had to go to one of their lodge houses to hear him tell his story. And that was phenomenal. And I don't think I'd heard anything of you again, Rod, until Yvonne mentioned you for this weekend. So thank you for your service. A couple of years ago, Don asked me if I would be a part of a Native American conference that he was putting on, a Fellowship of the Spirit Native American conference in the East, in the Northeast. And, you know, I said, yeah. And I said, but Don, I got to tell you, you know, I can't tell you exactly what tribal heritage I am. I can't tell you, you know, any specifics like many people are able to do. And I said, so I feel really kind of bad. I feel almost kind of like a fraud. And Don said to me, he started laughing, and he said, and some of you who know Don can just hear him saying this. He said, oh, come on. He said, you talk Native, you dress Native, you think Native, you look Native. He said, why don't you just get over it and just claim who you are? And I just started laughing, and I said, okay. Because I really felt, you remember that, Don? You do. Yeah. And I was just like, okay, I'll do it. You know, so I do have Native American heritage, and I wish I could tell you what it was. You know, I was born in 1953. And when I was born, and when my mother was born, and her siblings were born, being Native was not something that people were necessarily proud of. I grew up here in Santa Fe, New Mexico. I was born in Santa Fe, New Mexico. I've lived here my whole life. And where we are, we have three cultures. We have more now, but back then it was like I grew up surrounded by Hispanics and by Native Americans and by what we called the Anglo, which was the white people. And we all pretty much got along, except when you didn't, you know, we all pretty well got along except when you didn't. And so it didn't seem like it was a very important thing for me to know what my heritage really was. It was just like, I looked like everybody here, you know, and everybody was a mix of various things. And what I've realized today is that I am a mixture of all three cultures. I really am. And so I really think that I am the coming together of what I think the Creator really wants us to be, which is a part of, and that we all really have to come together in our world, in our communities, in our homes. It doesn't matter what we are. It doesn't matter what we think we are. The point is how are we living? And for me, let me put it this way. The point for me is, how am I living? How am I showing up? Am I being the person that God would have me be? Am I the person that the Creator wants me to be? Am I fully myself? Can I show up and it doesn't matter what anybody thinks of me? Can I just be me? Can I just be me? You know, I after Rod finished speaking, I got down and said a couple of prayers, and I just said, God, let me know that I'm enough. Because I had an instant of a fraction of a second where I just thought, I'm not enough. I'm not enough. I'm not enough. And what I got, which is what my Creator always gives me, is, you are enough. You are more than enough. That's the lie that the disease tells you, is that you're not enough, because the disease doesn't want you to be a part of. The disease wants to separate you from everyone and from it. Because if I'm separated, there's no chance that I'm going to show up and be connected and carry a message of any depth and of any weight and of any hope. So the disease is constantly active within me, constantly active within me, wanting to separate me from you. Because it knows that if I'm separated from you, if I'm isolated, it'll feed on me and it'll feed on me. And before I know it, I'm sucked back into the clutches of the disease, the family disease of alcoholism, which tells me I'm not enough. I'm not okay. I'm wrong. I'm bad. I'm less than. Everybody else is better than I am. My first sponsor said one thing to me one time. She said, why don't you just be average? Can't you just be average? And I thought, oh my God, what is wrong with her? I don't do average. I don't do average. I'm not average. Because I was always either better than or I was worse than. What I found out for myself is I'm average. I'm average. I'm just the average person with all my problems, all my difficulties, all my joys, everything. I am average. So my job is to stay as connected to the God of my understanding as I possibly can be. And I'll tell you that there are some days that that's easier to do than others. Some days I wake up, man, and it's like me and the Creator, we're just walking hand in hand. It's like, we are right there. We are right there. If some of you are on social media, Don has this post that he puts up every day. And it's this circle, and it's kind of like, after meditation, where are you on this circle? And it's anywhere from 1 through, I think it's 10. I think it used to be 12, Don, but now I think it's 10. And it's like from, it ain't so good to, man, it doesn't get better than this. And there's been times, you know, in the past when I wanted to click on, it doesn't get better than this. But, you know, I'm always paying attention. And I've never seen anybody click or put anything like, it doesn't get better than this. And I thought, well, you shouldn't do that, because what will they think? And then one day this summer, I thought, I'm going to click on that, because that's how it feels to me. It doesn't get better than this. It doesn't get better than this. And so I put it 10. It doesn't get better than this. And it was like, that's the truth. That's the truth. But I'm afraid that if I tell you the truth and I'm in that moment of what doesn't get better than this, that you're going to think badly of me. Like I'm full of ego, or I'm lying to myself. I'm in denial. I don't know what's real. And I'll tell you today, there are many days when I wake up and I go through my days and I think it doesn't get better than this. And that's not to say that there's not problems. There are problems and there are difficulties. The thing is that I have a God that carries me on the palm of his hand and carries me through all those difficulties and all those problems. And there's times that I have to, that I wake up and I say, I can't do it. This is too big for me. I cannot do it. And you're going to have to do this day for me. You're going to have to do these 10 minutes for me. You're going to have to do this for me. You're going to have to carry me through this because I don't have it in me. I cannot do it. And my creator, my God does. My God does. Don mentioned in his story this morning a dear friend who was one of his sponsors and mentors, Don Pritz out of Denver, Colorado. There's this conference in the mountains of Colorado that I've been going to for many, many years. And when Don was still alive, he'd have this potluck at his house and people would gather from all over the world and all over the country for his Wednesday night potluck before we went up to the mountain for this conference. And he came up to me one day and he said something to me like, this was the year before he passed away. And I remember it very well. Because he said, you're the next generation coming up. He said, you are the next generation and you are going to be one of the elders. And I started to cry. And I said, Don, I can't do it. I said, Don, I can't do it. I said, I feel like a baby. I feel like a baby doing this stuff. And he just smiled and let me look in those deep, beautiful blue eyes of his. And he says, yeah. He says, that's why I say I'm just a little kid. I'm just a little kid. You see, I used to think that the longer I was in Al-Anon, the less I was going to need to do all the stuff that we talk about. The meetings, the steps, sponsoring, service, being sponsored. I thought that I was going to be in this for a while and the day would magically come when I didn't have to do any of this and I could just go about my merry way and not have to do anything. That day hasn't come. In fact, what I found is that the more I'm in this program, the longer I'm in this program, the longer I'm in recovery, the more as I wake up, because I do wake up, I work these steps and my spirit wakes up more and more. And as my spirit wakes up more and more, what I find is that there are those areas that all of a sudden I see where I've fallen asleep or I've never woken up at all. Never woken up at all. And it's something brand new to be taken. So the longer I'm in this program, the more I see that I need the God of my understanding more than I ever did. Well, I grew up affected by a father's drinking, affected by my mother's family disease of alcoholism. And what my mother did was she didn't talk. She didn't talk. She was the silent sufferer. I learned how to be the silent sufferer. I learned how to be the victim. I learned how to be the martyr. And I was the good kid. I had a brother who was 5 years younger than me, and he was the kid who was always in trouble. So even at a young age, I looked better than the one standing next to me, you know? I'm really feeling called to talk about my dad a lot, so I'm just going to go for it. My dad grew up on a farm, a ranch here in where I live. It's Powake, New Mexico, just about 16 miles north of Santa Fe. And he grew up since the age of 4, working in the fields, you know, with the corn and, you know, the planting, getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning and doing all that stuff. And taking trips in the wagon when he was a little bit older with my grandfather, who I never knew. He died before I was born, and it would take him a day to get in the wagon and pulled by horses to go from where we live, the 16 miles into Santa Fe. And they'd stay in Santa Fe and sell the stuff and then, you know, come back home. And my dad doesn't talk much about those days. He kept very quiet. And I really think that my grandfather was an alcoholic. He was one of the bootleggers here in the valley that my dad told me stories of. He said the bus would come from Las Cruces, New Mexico, and go up to Denver, and it would drop off the empties and pick up filled bottles on the trips going back and forth. And so I've got a feeling that my dad really did grow up with alcoholism. And when I look at the other members of his other two siblings, an aunt and an uncle, and watching their families and watching them, I really think that alcoholism was a big factor, though my dad never talked about it. And as Stella was talking about, you know, we carry these traumas, these intergenerational traumas. We have them from in our genes. And I think I've carried mine from a very, very long time. And that's not to say that I can't recover from them, because I will tell you that I have. You know, when I was a child, I was a victim of sexual abuse. And I used that for the longest time. I used that to not have to be present in a relationship. I used it to have conversations with people. I used it to be a victim. I used it so that if anything went wrong or you wanted to blame me for something, I could say something to the effect of, well, if you'd have had this happen to you, you would feel this way too. This is why I don't succeed. This is why there's problems. And so I had that happen to me as a child. And by the time I was 17, I was married. And by the time I was 21, I divorced that husband and I had a daughter. And then when I was just before I turned 24, I met my current husband, Tom. Tom and I have been married now for 42 years. I can't believe it. I can't believe it's been that long, 42 years. And I, you know, we had the first 9 years of our lives together in active alcoholism and drug addiction. Tom has always said to me, nothing, you can share anything about me that you need to share if it's going to help somebody. And so when I tell you that he is an alcoholic and a heroin addict, I'm not telling anything that I know he wouldn't be happy with me telling. And I will tell you that he is in his program and he is sober and he's been clean. And he's got 34 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, clean and sober. And I've got 34 years in my Al-Anon program. I came to my very first meeting July 2nd of 1986. When I was telling you that I wanted to talk about my dad, or that's what I'm called to talk to you about. So we'll see if that's happening. When I got to, I was in Al-Anon for 2 years before I ever got a sponsor. And I got my sponsor because I'd always told myself that if he just got clean and sober, I'd be okay. And I was going to meetings. I was going to 4 and 5 meetings a week. And he was clean and he was sober. And he loved Alcoholics Anonymous. Oh, my God, he loved Alcoholics Anonymous. I was in Al-Anon simply because I wanted to keep him, because I wanted to look like I was getting this program. I had no intentions of getting it. I just wanted to keep him. I thought the program was dumb. I thought it was stupid. I thought everybody in the program was stupid. I thought they were dumb and they talked about God and I didn't like hearing that. And after 2 years, I realized, well, what happened, it was a Sunday afternoon and I reached what I called my gift of desperation, my gift of desperation. And if you think of that gift of desperation, the first letters of that phrase are G-O-D. In having that gift of desperation, I found my God, because I finally got teachable. Finally getting desperate, I became teachable. I got to a place where I was willing to talk to somebody. And what happened was a few days after this day, I met a woman at a meeting and I was going to ask her if she'd listen to a 4-step. And what came out of my mouth was, would you sponsor me? And that was not my intention because I don't ask for help. And I was really surprised that those words came out of my mouth. And we met the next Saturday and she told me what she required of me. And she started taking me through those steps. And I started to change slightly, slightly. Here's the problem. Here's the big problem. My husband was clean and sober when I first came into Al-Anon. When I looked at that first step and it said, I'm powerless over alcohol and my life is unmanageable, it was like, yeah, I get it. But I didn't get it. I got it up here as words. I got it up here as theory. I didn't get it. It was just theory, because I didn't have to have the experience of going through the steps with his drinking, because he was already sober. Later on, as time went on, I had to work those steps. I had to work, and with each working of those steps, I really started to get the first step. I had to look at the fact that I was trying to manage and control his recovery. I wanted him to get the right person. I wanted him to get, you know, to get a big book sponsor. I wanted him to do this. I wanted him to do that. And if he would only do it my way, if he would just listen to what I suggested, after all, I'm the one that's been working the steps for like 3 years. He hasn't been, you know, and it was just like I had these ideas of what he needed to do. And so in doing that, I began to get a little bit deeper awareness of being a person whose life was unmanageable and who was powerless over alcohol and over the alcoholic. And through the years, I've had to look at how I'm the powerlessness. I'll give you, for instance, I currently have a 21-year-old grandson who has been struggling with recovery, and he went into treatment. He came out, and I don't know where he is now. I've had to put him and his process, his drinking and addiction, through the steps. I have no control over him. There's a line in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous that says this, and I can't remember where it is. It's either in There Is a Solution or More About Alcoholism. It says, the alcoholic, the great obsession is that they will control and enjoy their drinking. And I've had to look at it from the standpoint of, it is my great obsession that I'm going to control and enjoy the alcoholic in my life. And what I found out is that if I'm trying to control them, I'm not enjoying them. However, if I'm enjoying them, there's no need to try and control them. And I've really gotten that. And I will tell you that with my grandson, I am able to enjoy that kid today. I really, truly am able to enjoy him, and not need to make him be anything. Whether or not he gets sober or whether he doesn't, I love that kid just the way he is, and I can enjoy him and be with him. So I started working the steps with this woman, and then came the day when she couldn't sponsor me anymore. And I went through some hard stuff. And one of the things that happened to me was I went about a year, year and a half without a sponsor. And without a sponsor, what happens to me is that the disease can get in there and it messes with me. It starts telling me stuff and I start believing it. Now, here's the thing. I was still going to meetings. I was still sponsoring. Shame on me, sponsoring without having a sponsor. But I was doing that. I was doing service work. So I was involved, you know, in the program. We do have a triangle, though, and I know AA has one too. And one side of the triangle says unity. I take the body to the fellowship. I was doing that. One side of the other triangle says service. I was doing that. I was sponsoring. I was doing service in the area. The bottom side of the triangle says recovery. That means I put my mind through the recovery process, and I was not doing that. I was not doing that. Now, I was doing my readings in the morning and I was saying my prayers, but all of that was just halfways. I wasn't really showing up for it. I was giving it lip service. So a three-sided triangle, it's like a three-sided stool. It's like a stool that has three legs. And I'm trying to balance myself and sit on a two-legged stool, and I didn't have the steps in place. So what happened was, a year without a sponsor. Long story short, my husband's driving the car. We're going up the mountains, and my daughter's in the back seat. And I lost it with my husband, and I grabbed hold of the steering wheel with all my might, and I yanked it, and we nearly went off the side of the road. And he's yelling at me, asking me, what's wrong with you? My daughter's in the backseat yelling, screaming, going, what's wrong? What's wrong? Oh my gosh, what's wrong? And I'm sitting there in the car on the passenger side asking myself, what in the world did you just do? What did you just do? Next morning, I'm sitting in prayer. Because, you know, there's nothing like a tough time to get you into, to get me into prayer anyway. And I sat in prayer and I said, God, what in the world happened to me? what happened to me? The God of my understanding is so incredible, because what I got was this. And every time I ask a question and I really ask it and I say a prayer and it comes from the very depths of my being and I mean it with everything in me, I get an answer. And what came to me was this: you quit working the steps. You quit working the steps. And boy, I'll tell you, did that ring true? That rang so true. I had. So I got serious about getting a sponsor, and I found one, and she's been my sponsor now for about 30 years. And I started going back, and I started making those amends. And when it came time to make amends to my father, my sponsor said to me, she asked me, do you know why you're going to make amends to your father? And, you know, the truth was, I wasn't sure. I just knew that I owed him some amends. And we sat and we talked, and she says, you owe your father amends because you never gave him the time and the respect that he deserved. That was so true. I never did give my father the time and the respect that he deserved. My dad was one of the most kindest, most caring men I have ever known in my whole entire life. He was alcoholic, yes, and he loved his family. He tried to put his family first as much as he possibly could. In the last 20 years of his life, it would be a Saturday morning, and you know, it would be like 6:30, 7 o'clock, and it'd be summertime, and we'd hear the mower going, and it'd be right outside, and Tom would go, your dad's here. He's mowing the lawn. I'm like, yeah, I know. I want time to sleep. I know. And, you know, I wasn't going to say anything because that's how he showed his love. Or he would, you know, mow the weeds. Tom built us the house that we live in today. And my dad worked on this house and helped Tom build it. And my dad would take no money for helping build this home. He said, no, he said, I just want to help you with it. That's how loving my father was. So I realized that I really owed my dad amends for keeping the love I had from him and for being disrespectful and not giving him the time. I want to share with you a story that I am not proud of at all, but I don't like it, and I don't like sharing it, and I'm going to share it. When I was married the first time, my dad was standing in the church at the back with me, and he said, when we get to the altar, he said, I want to hug you and I want to kiss you. And I said, okay, Dad, okay. And I said, okay, without any intentions that I was going to let him. But I said, okay. And my dad walked me up to the altar, and I turned immediately away from my dad. And we had the ceremony and we had the reception. And at the end of the night, the bravery of this man, because he had the guts. He was brave to come to me and say to me that night, you must be very ashamed of me. And I said, oh, Dad, I said, why would you say that? I'm not. Why would you say that? And he said, you didn't let me hug you and you didn't let me kiss you. I said, oh, Dad, I said, I forgot. I said, you know, I forgot. I didn't forget at all. I wasn't going to do it. I was angry with my dad, and I didn't know why I was angry. You know, I was angry at my dad. And I didn't even get the depth of what I'd done to my dad until my youngest daughter got married. And my youngest daughter got married outside in the mountains here in New Mexico, at what used to be the old Girl Scout Lodge. In winter now they rent ski equipment there. She got married there, and she asked both her father and myself if we would walk her to where the ceremony was going to take place. And we said, oh, yeah. I mean, I was so honored. I was really honored. And it was as I was walking my daughter on one side of her, my husband on the other, that we got to where the I'm going to call it the stage. It's not a stage. It was the fire, the barbecue fire pit is what it was, you know. And so we got to that, you know, and I hugged my daughter. And I told her how much I loved her. I got in that moment what I had stolen from my father. I really got what I had stolen from my father. I had stolen from my father the opportunity for him to show me how much he loved me. And for him to tell me that he loved me and to hug me. I heard a very wise man once say that when he did his step work, he said a prayer. And the prayer that he had was for God to be able to let him feel the harm that he had caused other people and to feel their pain. And I will tell you that in that moment, I felt the pain that I gave my dad. I felt it. I felt it. I'd already made amends to my dad when this happened, when my daughter's wedding ceremony happened. You see, I started doing this thing with my dad where I would go into his house and my mom would be at the stove at the kitchen and I'd say, "Hi, Mom, how are you?" And she says, "I'm okay." And I said, "Where's Dad?" And she'd say, "Oh, well, he's over there somewhere." And I said, "Oh, okay." And she'd go, "Well, where are you going?" I said, "Well, I'm going to go find Dad." And she'd go, "Well, what for?" You see, my mother was always mad at my father. Till the day my dad died, my mother was very angry with my father. And she'd like, "Whatever, do whatever, you know." And so I'd go and I'd sit with my dad for a while. And I'd sit and I'd ask about his day. And during this time, my dad worked at the school. He was the maintenance man here at the school here in Pewaukee at the middle school. And the kids used to call him Grandpa because my oldest daughter was going to school there. And she called him Grandpa. So all the kids would call him Grandpa. It was so cute, you know, it was so cute. And so I talked to him and he'd tell me about what happened during his day. And I say, "Oh, Dad," I said, "that's great. That's great." And that would be, and then I leave. And little by little, as time went on, I would sit with him. Sometimes I'd hold his hand. And sometimes, you know, as I was leaving, I'd give him a hug or I'd peck his cheek. And I remember one day I said, "Daddy, I love you." And he had this little bald spot. And I just kind of like gave him this little knuckle noogie, you know, on the top of his bald spot. And I said, "I love you, Dad." And he goes, "I love you too." And I left. And it was shortly after that that we were headed up to the mountains of Colorado for a conference, and Dad came in, and in fact, you know what conference this was? This is incredible. It was a conference in Ignacio, Colorado. It was an Indians in Sobriety camp out there. I was going to share my story that weekend, and my dad came over, and he said, "Mijita," he says, "you know, I want to say bye to you." He says, "I know you're leaving for the weekend and I'll see you when you come back." He said, "But I worry about you all the time." He said, "I worry when you're gone." He said, "I wish you didn't go because I really would like you to just stay here and home. And that way I know you're here and I know you're safe and I know you're okay." My God, my dad would have loved COVID times because he would have known where I was all the time at home, you know, he wouldn't have to worry about me. But he came over and he said, "I just want to tell you, I love you and give you a hug." And I said, so much. And I knew that day that my relationship with my dad had been healed. You know, amends is not about saying words. It's not about saying I'm sorry. Amends is to mend, to fix, to repair. And I knew that my relationship with my dad had been repaired. But one of the things that happened with my dad around the time that my youngest daughter got married, where I had the realization of just what I'd stolen from my dad, and when I didn't let him hug me and kiss me at that wedding ceremony, was that a few months prior to that, he had been diagnosed with prostate cancer that had metastasized in his lungs and in his bones. And by the time they found it, and they did a PET scan, which is a scan of your entire body, and it shows where the cancer is. I'm so grateful, you know. I mean, there's some things about growing up in active alcoholism that I think are still really good tools today for me. And that's that when I saw the PET scan and I saw the black and the shadowed and the gray parts of his skeleton. I didn't know what it was, or I couldn't admit to myself what it was. And that was that the cancer was just everywhere, everywhere in him, everywhere. And I became his primary caregiver. I took him to all his appointments. And when it got worse, and he, you know, his bones were so brittle. What happens when you have bone cancer is that your bones get so brittle that they become, I mean, to the stage where my dad was, is that they're like honeycombs. And he'd broken a hip, he broke an arm. I mean, he was just, you know, it was just brittle. And, but I got closer to my dad. I got closer to him. My relationship with my dad, oh my God, I was in love with my dad. I was absolutely in love with him. I just was, my love for him was just from the very depths of me. And he would ask me to do things like take him for rides. And he would ask me to take him for rides through all the places that he'd been before, you know. And some of it were places that he'd been when he was a kid growing up, and he'd tell me the stories. And some of the places that he'd worked with my husband, Tom, because in the last like 10 years of his life, he worked with my husband, Tom, doing construction at the age, I'm not kidding you, at the age of 79. He's still getting on scaffolding and getting on ladders and doing the deal. And I remember one time going to Tom when they were at work, and I said, Tom, I said, what are you doing? You've got my dad on that ladder. You cannot have him there. Get him down from that ladder right now. And Tom looked at me and he's like, I'm not telling your dad to not get on that ladder. I said, your dad wants to get on that ladder. He's going to get on that ladder. If you don't want him on that ladder, you tell him to get off. And when he said that, I thought, this is my dad. This is who he is. This is his life. This is how he lives. This is how he gives. This is how he can't not work, you know? And so, of course, I couldn't take that away from him. But he would have me drive him to these places. And he goes, I remember this woman. We worked for this woman. And he'd tell me these stories about them. And then he'd take me to the next place. And he goes, yeah, we did that wall. Oh, we did that roof. Oh, we did that addition there. Oh, we did that bath. I mean, he would just have these things that he'd tell me, you know, that he had been part of. He was just sharing things that were so important to him in his life. See, because my dad's life in working with my husband, Tom, was so important to him. Tom was in recovery. Tom was a sober, clean member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's not that they didn't have their stuff come up. Oh my gosh, Tom would say sometimes, your dad is like Ford, has always got a better idea, you know? And you know, so it's like sometimes they butt heads. But my dad loved Tom. He absolutely loved Tom. And Tom absolutely loved my dad. And so he was trying to tell me how much and how important it was that he had those years with Tom working with him. And towards the end, I remember going to his house, and he was out watering his grapevines underneath his apple trees. And I said, Dad, I said, what are you doing? He goes, well, I'm watering. He had this big smile on his face. And I said, Dad, you've got a broken arm. You're on crutches. I mean, he was. He had a crutch under each arm. And he had the watering hose in one hand, and he's watering his little grapevines. And the pleasure that he gave me was, I'm almost done. He says, I'll be in a minute. And I said, well, Dad, I said, aren't you in pain? He goes, no, I'm not in any pain. And I never knew with my dad if he was never in any pain or if he was just, he just wasn't going to let me know, you know, because that's kind of the man he was. And I remember sitting at his feet one day. It was the end of April. And he couldn't sit up straight, because his little back was already, you know, bowed. So he was sitting like this. So he was sitting with his head down, and I was sitting at his feet, and I was looking up at him. And he said, Nikita, he said, you're really happy, aren't you? He said, and you're really happy in your life with Tom, aren't you? And I said, Dad, I said, you know what? I said, I really am. I really am. I am really happy. Tom and I are really happy. And he said, I am so glad. I'm so glad. See, because he and my mom were still struggling. And he said, I can't tell you how happy that makes me. And as he got to the end of his life, I remember it was a Sunday, and he was sitting in his chair in his living room, and he says, I am so tired. He said, I've got to go to bed. And my dad was not the kind of man who went to bed during the day, even if he was sick. He did not do that. He did not go to bed until it was nighttime. And I said, well, that's okay, Dad. I said, you're tired, and you know, it's okay. Why don't I help you? So I helped him get to bed, and that's the last time that he never got up from bed again. And the next night, he said to me, he said, I really think I'm getting better. And I said, really, Dad? I said, you think you're getting better? He goes, oh, yeah. He said, I really think I'm getting better. I said, well, tell me why. Why do you think that? And you see, I would sit in prayer and meditation in the morning. And I'd have those days when I think, I can't do this. I can't do this. This is too big for me. I cannot go over to my dad's. I cannot spare to see him like this. It's too hard. It's too painful. I can't do it. And then he would call and he'd say, are you going to bring me breakfast? And I'd say, yeah, Dad, I'll be right there. And I'm thinking, I don't want to take him breakfast. I don't want to, you know, scramble some eggs, make him some toast and take him breakfast. And then I'd get up and I'd say, God, you're going to have to give me the power to do this because I don't have the power to do this. If I'm going to do this, you give me the power because I can't. I can't. It's too much. So will you come with me? And we'd go and we'd take my dad breakfast, you know? And so everything I did only because of the power of the Creator. That's the only reason. And there were days that I would sit there and I would think, I don't want to lie to my dad as his life comes to an end. I want him to be able to be ready to go. And I don't want to fill him with false hope of like, you're going to get better, Dad. Don't worry. No, this isn't the end. You know, you're going to get better. I want to be able to be honest, because what a horrible thing would it be to not be able to be honest with someone at the end of their life. But I don't want to say whatever words need to be said without knowing it's the right time. So I'm going to really trust God that you're going to give me the right time for the right words. So my dad's in bed, it's Monday night, and he says, yeah, I think I'm getting better. I said, really, Dad, really? You think you're getting better? He goes, yeah. And I said, well, can you tell me why? And he goes, oh, yeah. He said, I think I'm getting better because my body feels lighter. I said, ah, your body feels lighter. You know those moments when you say something and you go, that wasn't for me. That wasn't for me. And what I said to my dad was this, because God, I knew God would give me the words that I needed when I needed them. What God gave me to say was this, well, Dad, I said, I think I know why you feel lighter. Do you want me to tell you why? And he goes, oh, yeah. He goes, I want to know why. And I said, I think your body feels lighter because your spirit's ready to go, but your body's not letting it. And he said, well, I better let it go. Better let it go. And that was the last conversation that I had with my dad while he was still cognizant, that he was cognizant in terms of being able to converse with me. Because the next day he went into what they call a coma. Now, from my experience with my brother, because my brother died when he was 28 years old, and I'm so grateful that I had a year in the program when my brother died. Because in the hospital, my brother was in a coma for 3 days, and the doctors and the nurses would say, you can talk to him, but he's not going to hear you. You can touch him, but he's not going to feel you. I will tell you that with my brother, when I talked to him, tears would stream down his face. And when I touched him, when I'd stroke his arm, his body would quiver. I believe in the world of the spirit. Our spirits can talk to the spirit of the other person. I really think they hear. So I was sitting at my dad's bedside. I can't remember now if it was the day before, I think it was the day before he passed away. And I said, Dad, I said, you know, I talk about you all over the country. I said, I talk about you all over the world. Because I wanted to keep my dad company. I wanted to converse with him, even though, quote unquote, he was in a coma and wouldn't hear and wouldn't feel. And I said, I talk about you all the time. I said, I tell them what an incredible, loving, caring man you were and how you put your family first. I tell them about how you used to make breakfast for us when I was growing up every day. You make bacon and eggs and toast and, you know, fried potatoes every morning, every single morning. My dad didn't cheap shot us with cereal, you know? It's like, man, he went the full breakfast. He really did. Every day. I said, I tell him about that. I tell him about the times that you take our garbage and you throw it because we live in the country, so you have to take your own garbage. We don't have the garbage service. We do today. We didn't then. I tell him about how you show up early on the morning, on Saturday mornings, and you mow our lawn because you just love us so much and you want to do something for us. I tell them how a loving, caring man you were. The kind of man that I had to go to Al-Anon to learn to be. I had to go to Al-Anon to learn how to be kind, to learn how to be caring, to learn how to be loving, which you just naturally do. And I said, Dad, I said, I don't think I ever told you the story of when Carlos, who's my brother, when he died. I said, I'm gonna tell it to you, Dad. And so I started telling my dad the story of when my brother died. And it goes like this. This is what I said to my dad. I said, you know that Mom and I spent the last 3 days of his life at the cardiac unit at the hospital because he was in a coma. And I said, the last night that he was there, Mom and I walked into his room. And the nurses and the doctors were bringing him back again with the defibrillators for easily the 20th time. And I got Mom and I steered her out of there and we started to walk around the floor of the cardiac unit. And I said, Dad, I said, I asked Mom a question, which looking back seems like a stupid question, but I asked it. And I said, Mom, how are you doing? And she said, I'm not doing very well. And I said, really, Mom? I said, why not? And she said, I'm afraid of where he's going to end up. When she said that, I said to my dad, I realized that my mom had the kind of God that I'd come into Al-Anon with. The kind of God that I had been trying to convince myself didn't exist because if he did exist, he'd send me to hell. And I realized that my mom had that kind of God, a God that was going to punish my brother for the things he'd done. And what came out of my mouth, because we have those moments, what came out of my mouth was this. You know what, Mom? I said, I really believe that God loves us so much that before we do anything wrong, we're forgiven. Way before we've even done it. Before we've even had a thought of doing what we're going to do wrong, we're forgiven. And my mom stopped and she turned to me and looked me in the eye and she says, do you really believe that? Do you really believe that? And I stopped for a minute. Because I really had to know, because this is important. Do I believe that? Do I really believe that? And I'm grateful I had a year in Al-Anon, because if it had not been for that year, I don't know that I would have had this answer. Because somehow you all were sneaking in with this God stuff and touching me, and I didn't know it. And I looked at my mom finally, and I said, you know what, Mom? I said, I really do believe that. I really believe that God loves us so much that before we ever even think of doing anything wrong, we're forgiven. And we walked on a little bit and we got to my brother's room and my mom said to me, she says, okay. She says, if God wants him that bad, he can have him. When she said that, I realized that God is so good that he waited until my mother was ready to let her son go, to take him. And we got to the door of his room, and the doctor was coming out, and he said, "I'm really sorry, we did all we could." And we said, "We know." We said, "Thank you very much. Thank you." Out of everything, so to finish, as I'm telling this story to my father, the energy in the room is building and building and building. The energy in the room is so powerful. It felt like it had a life, which I know some of you realize it did. It did have a life. The presence was there. The presence was there. Spirit was there. Spirit was present. And when I said the words to my dad that I said to my mother, which was, "Yeah, I really do believe," all of a sudden, all the energy went out of the room. It was just like, what's going on? And what I realized was my dad also had that kind of God. He had the kind of God that he was afraid to go home to. And in hearing that there was a God who was forgiving, that didn't hold anything against us, my dad was able to surrender his life here on earth, knowing he was going to go and be held in loving arms. I never know how the Creator is going to use me. I think I know, and I don't know. You see, in Al-Anon, our 12 steps says we carry this message to others and we practice these principles in all our affairs. I think sometimes our message can be so strong, can be so powerful. There's no need for words. And I think the greatest message that we have is a message of love, a message of love. All I wanted, really, was to be loved. I wanted to belong. I wanted to be loved. Because of this program, because of the 12 steps, because of the God that was given to me because of these 12 steps, I know I belong. And I have a God. And I have an awakened spirit. And my job is just to show up, be present, be willing to receive and be willing to give the love. That's all. That's all. And it doesn't matter who I give this love to. The more love I give, the more love I have to give. And the more I'm able to receive. Pretty simple. It's pretty simple. And isn't that one of the hardest things to do? It's taken all my time in Al-Anon and all my step work and all my prayer and all my meditation and all the sponsoring and all the meeting with my sponsors, my sponsees and the meetings I've done to get to a place where I can just be me and I can just acknowledge that there's love to be received and be willing to receive it and able to receive it and be more than willing to give it and to be vulnerable so that you can see me for who I truly am. Don often says that we have these earth suits, and that's really all they are. They're just earth suits. Because underneath, we're all the same. Underneath, we all want the same thing. We want to be loved. We want to belong. And it took me coming here, being with you, to be able to have that gift. The gift of desperation, which happens time and time again for me, believe me. I've had more than one gift of desperation. And each one leads me to a deeper awareness, a deeper awakening, a deeper reliance, and a deeper dependency upon the God of my understanding. And I'm so grateful for that. And thank you for the opportunity and the pleasure to be with you. God bless. Thank you.
Hey, you guys, you want to unmute yourself?
Thank you.
Thank you, Juanita.
I know we're running a little bit slow, so I'm going to take a couple of people here with the hands up. And then we'll proceed with Janelle and Olivia. But Kelly, oh, sorry, I just muted you. Can you unmute yourself again? I'm sorry. What did I do? Here. Bye again. Okay. Kelly. There you go.
Hi, my name is Kelly, and I'm an alcoholic. And what a beautiful share, Juanita. Thank you so much. You know, it's been awesome from the beginning. Dawn, you touch my heart every time I hear you. Rod, you know, I related to so much. I lost a brother in a drunk driving accident also. And Juanita, when you talked about your dad, my dad tells me all the time, and he's still alive and he's 85. I'll never quit worrying about you. See, they adopted me when I was a little girl. And when my brother got killed, the state troopers came to the door, and my dad asked if it was his daughter. I was 20 years old then. And, you know, I'm 51 today, and I can be that daughter that calls my dad every day and tells him that I love him and love my parents. Because, see, when I was unlovable, they still loved me. When I couldn't love myself, they still loved me. You know, and you talk about your dad, I'm a daddy's girl. And you touched my heart. It's the second time I've heard you, and the second time I've cried. So thank you.
Thank you, Kelly. Delta, can you unmute yourself?
There, I unmuted myself, right?
There, I hear your voice, Delta.
Oh, hello. You hear me? Hi, Yvonne. Juanita, thank you so much. This is no mistake. Somebody sent me the flyer for Al-Anon Without Borders for Native Americans. And I lost my Matthew October 14th, 19 years ago. And he was a Native American from San Felipe Reservation in New Mexico. You know, we both had previous marriages and kids, and but in this relationship, you know, this man, you know, I used to tell him, you know, we're indigenous. I had a hard time with the word indigenous, and he says, oh, we're a bunch of Indians. I said, oh, okay, whatever. But in that relationship, he was a strong AA member. And he had 12 years when we met in AA, and I had 5 years. In that relationship, I was loved unconditionally. Forgiveness was natural. There was so much richness in that relationship that you never know until it's gone. And when I heard you say you weren't good enough, I always felt that coming from the islands to the continental United States, I was never good enough. Even today in the room sometimes, I feel like I'm being judged by Al-Anons, AAs, in and out of the rooms. But, you know, I think that's just a human thing, you know, how people hold themselves or whatnot. And I, too, never wanted to be an elder, a matriarch. I just hate that. And here I am, you know, here I am. And we're also elders of our recovery program. You know, when they told this man he was gonna die, he died 2 weeks before his 20th AA birthday of pancreatic cancer. And when the doctor told us that he had 3 months to live, when we got home, I cried like a baby, and he held me so tight. And he said, I kept pounding on his chest and saying, don't die, don't die. You just can't leave me. And he said, okay. So he held me tight and he says, okay, I won't die. But then he whispered in my ear, Delta, no matter what happens, you'll be surrounded by two of the strongest and most spiritual fellowship, AA and Al-Anon. And you know, that was the truth. This man died, AA and Al-Anon came out strong. We went to the Danville meeting all the time, and in AA, after he died, went up and picked up his 20-year chip and came into the audience and gave it to me. The power of our recovery and the power of who we are. Thank you.
Thank you, Delta. Good to see you. Joan. Can you unmute yourself, Joan?
Sorry, thank you.
Oh, there you go.
Hi, I just wanted to share one little thing. First of all, I love listening to all the speakers today. It was pretty awesome. And Juanita, I loved your story. And I just wanted to say, when my father was dying, they told me he was in a coma, and they said that the last thing to go is the hearing. So speak to him, tell him everything you've ever wanted to tell him. So I just wanted to share that, because even though you think they're not there and they don't, the hearing is the last thing to go, is what the hospice nurses told me. So with that, I will pass. And thank you for today, Yvonne. It was beautiful, everything. Thank you.
Thank you, Joan. Good to have you. McCall.
Thank you. My name is McCall, Grateful Al-Anon. Thank you so much, Juanita. I'll add my saltwater tears to the ocean of gratitude that we're experiencing. My higher power, who I happen to call Waldo, unbelievable. The past couple of weeks, my partner and I, who happens to be of service to this meeting, have been researching Indigenous people and the great spirit, the faith of American Indians. And I mean, the timing is just ideal. And then to hear you speak, while I've been struggling over the past week for feeling grateful that my mother's in the hospital, because I moved her in, my alcoholic, moved in with me for the first time since seventh grade, while I'm living with her and taking care of her as the end of her life comes and the effects of this disease on her body are really taking its toll. And I was feeling kind of ashamed that I was so grateful to be able to come to Al-Anon Without Borders and not be interrupted by having to go and make food or do anything. And to hear you say how hard caregiving was, and yet at the same time, what a blessing. I feel wanted, loved, and not alone. And I'm grateful. Thank you.
Thank you, McCall. All right, I'm going to do one more. Tanya? Tanya, can you, yeah, there you are.
Yeah. I am Tanya, and I'm an Al-Anon and an alcoholic. Whew, when you start talking about people's dads, boy, that just kills me. I love my dad very, very much, and he passed on, and, you know, it's only in hindsight that we get to see, like, just what that meant, you know? For whatever reason, you know, I always ask my dad, like, what tribe am I and all this other stuff? And he would never tell me. It's only when he died I found all this stuff, right? So I really related to how she said, you know, you feel like a fraud and you don't feel like, you know, you don't know the songs, you don't know the ceremonies, and you don't feel like you can really say, no, I'm Native, right? And, but I've always felt at home, you know, I've always, I don't know, the doors have always opened for me. And I end up in the middle of nowhere, Oklahoma, and I end up at this lodge with these Sun Dancers. And I was sharing, like, you know, how lost I feel without my dad. Like, this is my first big thing in my life without my father. And they said, Tanya, it doesn't matter where you came from. It doesn't matter that you don't know your songs. It's okay. Because way, 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 way back, your ancestors prayed for you to be right here, right now. And that's why you're here. And that's just kind of how that goes, you know? And I believe that. I believe that if you have good intentions and you walk in a good way, that the doors do open. And that you find that. You find what you need. You know, the Creator is gracious in that way. And I'm super grateful for that. And I'm super grateful for just the beauty. Like, I love Don C so much. You know, it's been a really rough time. And he always has that inspiration. And he's always been very kind. And I just can't send you enough love. So I'm super grateful. And thanks, guys. I love all of you.
Thank you, Tanya. All right. Thank you so much to Juanita.
Thanks so much.
Wonderful.